This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Sleep difficulties are common in children and adolescents, especially in some high-risk groups, such as young people with neurodevelopmental conditions or mental health problems. Clinicians working in pediatric or child mental health settings need an understanding of sleep disorders, as it is important to know how sleep disturbance impacts on a young person's physical and cognitive development and mental health. Hi, I'm Stacey Kelly-Marr, Digital Executive at the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. At our recent Sleep and Mental Health Conference, I had the chance to catch up with our speakers, Dr. Michael Farquhar, Dr. Genevieve Lee, Dr. Max Davey, and Dr. Sally Hobson to discuss the relationship between sleep, behaviour, and mental health, as well as some insights into assessment, management, and barriers to interventions. First of all, Dr. Michael Farquhar, consultant in sleep medicine at Evelina London Children's Hospital, shared some of his insights into the relationship between sleep and mental health. So, first of all, what constitutes a sleep problem?
So the simple answer to that is a sleep problem is anything which is going on that people are worried or concerned about. So sleep is very individual. So what is normal is something that varies very much from person to person. So, for example, one of the commonest things that we are asked is how much should my child be sleeping? And there isn't really a single answer to that. So there is a range of normal for sleep. So if we think about teenagers, for example, the median amount of sleep for a teenager is probably around about 9.5 hours. But there are some teenagers who probably can get by in as little as 7 hours sleep, and there are some teenagers who might need as much as 11 hours of sleep. And one of the difficulties is that if you have been told that 9 hours is the right amount of sleep for you, when actually you're somebody who needs 10 hours of sleep, then you find yourself sleepier and more tired than you think you should be because your idea of what's normal is not quite right. So we tend to think about this in terms of the consequences of sleep deprivation. So if you are getting an amount of sleep that means that you are rested and that you're not tired in the daytime, you are able to pay attention, to concentrate, you're not getting short-tempered and irritable and snappy all the time, and for kids, they're getting on at school and achieving as well as they should be, so they don't have any signs suggestive of sleep deprivation, then they are probably getting the right amount of sleep. And that varies very much from person to person. So the simplest way of defining a sleep problem is you have symptoms that suggest you are sleep deprived. And then once we've got to that point, it's about what's going on. And very broadly speaking, sleep problems can either be problems with the quantity of sleep, which is often a very common problem. So again, teenagers often end up having less opportunity for sleep for a number of reasons, some of which we've talked about during the meeting today. They often end up being relatively sleep deprived compared to the amount of sleep that they need. And then we think about the quality of sleep, and there are lots of things that can happen in sleep which can affect the quality, which can then lead to those problems in the daytime. Some of those are relatively simple and straightforward things. So one of the most common issues that can happen for children's sleep, which can affect sleep quality, is issues with how efficient and effective their breathing is. So if they've got disruption to how effective their breathing is at night, so that's usually a problem called obstructive sleep apnea, then that means they snore, they can gasp, they can grunt, they work harder for their breathing, and it ends up disrupting their sleep quality, which then makes them sleep deprived the next day. And so we think about whether there's something like that going on. The other thing about sleep, though, is that there are lots of weird and wonderful things that can go not wrong with sleep, but which can be different about sleep that people can think are unusual or get worried about. So most people are familiar with the idea of sleepwalking. So people who are still functionally asleep are up and about in the middle of the night and wandering around. The version of that that younger children get is something called a sleep terror, where rather than getting up and wandering around, what they do is they look like they've suddenly woken up, eyes wide open, they're shouting, they're screaming, they're running around in cots, they're shouting out things like stop, help, their hearts are racing, and it looks terrifying. That's why it gets the name. And parents are often convinced that something awful is happening to their child, but actually when you understand the underlying physiology, it's a relatively normal thing, and once you go into it a little bit, you can usually reassure and explain. So there's lots of weird and wonderful things, or apparently weird and wonderful things, that can go on in sleep. The most common sleep problems, though, for most parents is either my child is not going to bed when I want them to go to bed, or they are waking up when I don't want them to wake up, or they're waking up through the night. And it boils down to the most common sleep problem for families is parents are not getting enough sleep because of something that their children are doing. And a lot of that, again, is developmentally normal. And a lot of our work is about explaining to people what normal is and supporting them and working out which ones are the real problems. So it can constitute a whole load of things, and as with many of the things, when we stop and think about it, particularly in paediatrics and child mental health, it's about why is this a problem rather than necessarily what's going on. So some kids will do things that other children will do, and for some families that thing will be a problem and for some it won't be. So it's about unpacking it and working it all out.
So if a child has poor sleep continuously, is there a progression from poor sleep in childhood to adulthood?
Yes, there often is. So children learn to sleep. So sleep is something that we learn to do when we are young, and we develop sleep patterns, sleep routines quite early on. If on a very basic level you don't learn good sleep routines and habits relatively early, you are more likely to find it difficult to develop those routines and habits as you get older. So poor sleep in childhood can be predictors for sleep difficulties as you get older. There is probably an association with particularly thinking about sleep and mental health. So we are very used to thinking about sleep being a consequence of mental health problems, but we're increasingly understanding that sleep difficulties can sometimes be predisposing factors. So children who are chronically sleep deprived are more likely to have difficulties like depression or anxiety. But increasingly, we're probably understanding that sleep disruption for some people might be the early signs of evolving illnesses like depression, for example. And we tend to be more vulnerable once we've had those kind of problems once. We're probably a little bit more vulnerable to that happening when we're older. So there's a lot of value in thinking about establishing good sleep patterns early, both because it encourages hopefully a lifetime of good sleep routines and habits, but because equally we also understand that the better the foundation of sleep that we can establish earlier, the more likely we are to reduce long-term risks of physical and mental health problems. So there's a growing body of evidence that tells us that when we are chronically sleep deprived, our risks of physical and mental health difficulties in general tends to go up. So it is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and there's always, almost always, still the possibility of turning sleep around, but the longer we are used to doing something, the more difficult it comes to sort it back out again.
If it gets past the stage of teaching good sleep hygiene and we're looking at interventions and different kinds of interventions, when we're thinking about the many different kinds of medication that are out there, should children's sleep issues be treated with medication?
So I think the threshold for thinking about medications is one that we need to be very careful about. Because, as I kind of talked about already, a lot of the things that parents and even healthcare professionals might identify as sleep problems in children may actually be normal developmental issues. So not establishing good sleep routines and habits, bedtime resistance, things like waking up in the night are often, not always, but often related to normal developmental patterns and an understanding of the normal pattern of what happens when we sleep at night. So waking up at night, for example, is normal. We all wake up and settle back into sleep throughout the night without being aware of it. But the younger we are, the more likely we are to wake up and have an episode of wake that our parents are aware of, which then causes disruption. And making people aware of that, that a lot of the things that we perceive as problems may actually be normal, is really important, because what we don't want to do is give medications for something that is inconvenient but is not necessarily abnormal or pathological. And I think that, I don't think there's a huge, you know, so most families who come through our clinic are actually equally as averse to the idea of giving their children medications to try and help support sleep problems. Within the kids that we see in our clinic, there are a proportion who have primary sleep diseases. So we're one of the biggest centres in Europe for childhood narcolepsy. So narcolepsy is a rare, probably more common than people realise, but it's a rare sleep disorder. And although part of the treatment of that is non-medication based, most children with a diagnosis of narcolepsy are going to need medicines to treat their sleep problem. So there are some very definite conditions where medication is required to treat sleep difficulties. But what most people are thinking about for these are medicines to try and help children to stay asleep at night time. where we think children and families need support with this, we very much focus on getting the basics right first. So these are the foundation of everything about trying to improve sleep for all of us. So good sleep routines, good sleep habits. And then, as with many things in children, where what we're looking at is modifying habits and behaviours, what we then try and do is support families about the how to put in behavioural interventions that will result in the change that they want. So the biggest group of children that we see in our clinic are children with neurodevelopmental conditions like autism or conditions like ADHD. And the evidence is that actually, in terms of improving sleep, behavioural interventions are the things that are most likely to result in long-lasting improvement to those children's sleep. So we very much try and focus on getting that right first. However, there are then a group of children and families where all of that has been done and where everything that we would expect to have been tried to be done from a behavioural point of view has been done, and the children just don't respond to it. So when you've got particularly the more complex neurodevelopmental conditions, you can get everything absolutely right, and yet the child may still have a sleep pattern, which often is not that much of a problem to the child themselves. They will go to sleep when they want to go to sleep, they wake up when they want to wake up, and actually they function relatively well. But if they are functioning on 5 hours of sleep and they're starting their day at 3 o'clock in the morning, then the rest of the family don't function, and that can become a major issue. So we sometimes look at using medication to support families in those kind of situations. We use medications in two broad groups for those types of interventions. So we use melatonin, which is the natural hormone that the brain produces to try and encourage sleep onset at the beginning of the night. So we use melatonin as a medicine to try and increase that natural sleepiness at the end of the day. And that's often actually about giving families space, a better chance to be able to put in place the behavioural interventions that we know is going to make a difference. So if we can use a medication like melatonin to increase their chances of doing that over the course of 6 to 12 months, then we sometimes find that we're then able to withdraw the medication and the interventions can take over. But there are some children who benefit from medication like melatonin in the longer term. The other type of medicine would be more sedative-type medication, and our threshold for that is very high. We really have to feel that everything that we can possibly do to try and make things better has been done, and having done that, that the resulting sleep difficulty is so disruptive to either the child or the family or both, and there are no other alternative options available to us, that we will then look at using more sedative-type medicines to support the family. But we prescribe... I think probably we would prescribe a lot less medication than people would expect for a clinic like ours. And the overall message is very much that medication should be a last resort for children that are coming through sleep clinics. For that reason, we would really not be encouraging people to be using medication to support children's sleep without involvement of a more specialist service that is thinking about how to support. And that may be general paediatric service or community paediatric service or a service like ours or a CAMS team. But it should not be the first port of call for anyone. There are lots of things to try and work through first.
Next, I spoke to Dr. Jenna Vias-Lee, a clinical psychologist. She splits her working week between the Complex Autism National and Specialist CAMS and leading the psychology service in the Lambeth and Southwark Community Sleep Clinic. So you regularly hold workshops and teaching sessions for parents about sleep difficulties and best practice interventions. What are your top three tips for parents?
So putting in sleep interventions is often really, really tough for parents because, as we know, with any behavioural intervention, sometimes things get worse before they get better. So some of the things that I recommend to all of my parents that come to the workshops or to any teaching is to pick a time when you're going to be under a lesser amount of pressure than usual. So often that's a school holiday. Or it's when, if there are two parents around, if they're both going to be around over a weekend, or if you can get some help from a mum, a sister, a brother, an aunt, anybody, a friend, that can come and help you whilst you're in the initial stages of a strategy, because that's really important to feel supported. And to know that in the short term you might get less sleep, but short term pain for long term gain. And the second tip would be to do what works for you and your family. So there's lots of advice out there and there's lots of different strategies that you can try and use. But if you try and pick a goal that is smart, that's specific and measurable and achievable and realistic and time limited, then hopefully that goal is going to be something that works for your family. And the strategies that you're going to pick are going to be matched onto that goal and are more likely to be successful. And the third thing is, once you've picked a time that you think this might work and you've got your strategy and you've got your goals, to be really consistent. So to know that it's time limited, and that might be 4 days or it might be 4 weeks, and to stick to those strategies as tightly and as closely as you possibly can. And if you're finding that it's really tricky to do that, then that's a time to approach a health visitor or a GP or another sleep or mental health professional that can help support you in making sure that you are as consistent as you possibly can be.
If they do go to these professionals and we're looking at different kind of interventions, what kind of impact can they have, particularly in terms of exercise, for example?
There are many basic interventions that you can do to try and improve the quality of your sleep. So diet, bedtime routines, exercise. Exercise is an intervention that in the health world we try and prescribe to many, many different physical and mental health conditions. And for sleep, we know that if you're getting out and you're doing lots of exercise and it tires you out, we know that children are going to sleep better. And if you want to get a bit more technical about it, then the more exercise you do, the more your sleep pressure will build, and then you are likely to sleep at a more regular time and the quality of your sleep is likely to be better. Having said that, usually for most people, it's important to do exercise earlier in the evening and not so close to bedtime, because the effects of exercise can boost your energy levels in the short term. So doing it earlier in the day is always recommended.
What might be some of the barriers to interventions, whether that's exercise or anything else, when you're considering vulnerable groups in particular?
Yes, so in our clinic in South London, probably the main barrier to sleep interventions are psychosocial stressors. So things like housing. Housing is probably our number one barrier to intervention. It's near enough impossible to implement a sleep strategy, especially one that's going to get worse before it gets better, when you're living in a two-bed house and there's four or five of you. And if there's a single parent, that's often difficult as well. As we talked about before, it's really important to have support around you. If you're doing it on your own, it's going to be doubly as hard. Exercise in vulnerable groups such as children with neurodevelopmental disabilities or any kind of disability is always going to be a problem. One of the things that we're doing at the moment in the Lambeth and Southwark Sleep Clinic is we have some funding to look at a study where if we provide parents with a space for their children to do exercise and some facilitators that are specially trained in doing exercise with these vulnerable groups, can we get parents to engage in that and bring those children along, and do the children benefit from those exercises? What's their well-being like pre and post, and what's their quality of sleep like, both the child and the family as a whole?
Be very interesting to find out, and thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I then caught up with Dr. Max Davey, who is a consultant community paediatrician with Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust Community Services. He is also Health Promotion Officer at the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health.
Why should all mental health practitioners assess sleep as part of their assessment?
The first reason is that sleep is a very large portion of a child's life. And, you know, you spend between hopefully between 7 and 9 hours of sleep every night. And an awful lot happens during sleep, which can be have an effect on the daytime, which, of course, is going to be the main focus. So poor sleep can affect behaviour, it'll affect emotions, and it'll affect relationships. The converse is also true, because if you have poor relationships and behaviour difficulties during the day, that will have an effect on your sleep. So you get into vicious cycles. The reason why it's really important to address this is that often really quite basic, simple stuff can make a difference in breaking these cycles. This is not complex stuff, but if we miss it, we're missing huge opportunities to make things better.
One of the important messages that you mentioned during your talk was the fact that you need to teach children that it's okay to be bored while they're falling asleep. And how do you get that across to children?
I think that's a really good question. I think, generally speaking, the idea that it's okay to not be doing anything, to not be entertained, to not be being stimulated, is an idea that's difficult, that's increasingly difficult to communicate in our current culture. And I think having a bit of peace and stillness in your day is not a bad thing. I don't think it means that children have to be in complete silence, in the dark on their own. That's a cultural expectation that some people have, but it may mean that they can't have some of the things that they really want and they need to adapt. So instead of having their iPad, they need to maybe have some music or an audiobook. Instead of having their mum, they may need to have some sort of substitute. So it's not about being Spartan about, you know, you must just be absolutely silent and do nothing until you fall asleep, because a lot of adults don't do that. But it's about moving from this always connected, constantly overstimulated world into a more gentle, quiet bedtime. I think that's a good message for children to have, and I think it's a good message for us all to have, that it's okay to have quiet time. Not that I'm very good at it myself, I have to say.
I'm a fan of science podcasts. You mentioned technology, and I wanted to ask, in your role with the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, you're going to be working on guidance around screens, and there are many, many opinions about technology and how it can impact the mental health of children and teenagers. Yeah. So from both the evidence you've seen and your clinical experiences, how does it impact sleep in particular and mental health more broadly?
So I think the first thing to get rid of is the idea that there's anything toxic about screens. There's a small but vocal minority of professionals who feel that screens are inherently damaging children, and that is, there's no evidence for that. And in fact, a moderate amount of screens is probably better than none at all in terms of well-being. For excessive screen use, and there is such a thing as excessive screen use, there is a negative association with mental health, but which way that goes and whether it's causative is very unclear. My suspicion is it isn't causative. It's to do with the isolation of the child and the restriction of the child's activities leading to an excessive amount of screen time because of their mental health. Specifically on sleep, however, it's very true, and it's good that everyone's talking now about how the use of screens around bedtime is unhelpful. It stimulates the brain too much, both in terms of light and also because someone is wrong on the internet and you're feeling angry because they're wrong. And that's one of the reasons why I sometimes struggle to sleep when I've been online. So I do think it's important to control screens as part of a good sleep routine and to have that clear quiet time between screens and sleep. But any kind of moralising around screens and kind of moral panic about the screen should definitely be resisted.
You also mentioned working alongside CAMHS as a paediatrician, partially because of overlap and partially because of the service structure. So what changes to the structure or what new structures entirely could help that potentially?
I think the key thing is to look from the perspective of families and what is on offer locally. So look from the perspective of a family. What if I have this need, what is available to me? So let's say someone who might have ADHD, who has behavioural and disruptive behaviours in school, they need a good developmental assessment, prompt diagnosis, family support, and possibly some medical management and follow-up. Okay, so that's a reasonable expectation according to the NICE guidance. And then you look from that what's achievable, and you basically, if there's a barrier to that being achieved, you do everything you can to knock that down. So if there's an organisational barrier, that should be unnecessary. People should be able to pass through those barriers unimpeded. One of the ways of doing that is to actually have locally a document called a local offer, which already exists in special needs. I think that, and that's been advocated by the CQC in a recent report for mental health. Documents like that will be able to express to people, to local people, what is on offer for children with behavioural problems or emotional problems, and therefore act as a way of holding local agencies responsible for delivering them and responsible for breaking down the barriers that split up the system and make it not work currently. There's lots of complications about that, but that's the broad brush.
Finally, I was lucky enough to speak to Dr. Sally Hobson, specialty community paediatrician at the Mary Sheridan Centre in Lambeth. You designed and set up a multidisciplinary sleep clinic in Lambeth and Southwark with your colleague. So why are sleep problems a multidisciplinary issue?
So myself and Dr. Turnbull have set this clinic up in the past 18 months, and essentially we did that because we knew that the patients who come through our services, sleep problems are huge and they have a massive impact, and that clinicians don't often have the time to explore and support these families. And what we're really aware of when we assess these children is that children exist in a context, so they have their own psychology, they have their own development, their own medical problems, they exist within families, with siblings, with parents, with their own issues and with housing problems. And actually the sleep problem that presents is part of a whole sort of biopsychosocial formulation for that child, and without really fully understanding that context, it's really impossible to address the sleep problems. An example of that would be children who we see where housing is such an issue, and the children are vastly overcrowded, and in fact that can have such an impact that intervention to help the sleep problem can't really be done until the housing problems have been addressed. And it's quite a simplistic example. So the structure of our sleep clinic is that each child initially would have a medical assessment with a doctor, trying to kind of piece together everything that's going on for the child. But then we're within the multidisciplinary approach, we're fortunate to have psychology expertise, and they can help support our families through making changes and identifying what the areas are that they could work on and how to do that. And we're really aware that the doctors and psychologists have reasonably overlapping roles. But within that, we do also liaise with colleagues in social care, particularly about issues around housing, respite care for families, schools, particularly when children are in specialist provisions, are often really helpful in supporting children and families with behavioural change, and in recognising the impact of poor and then improved sleep on children. And we also have quite a lot of liaison with nursing colleagues and colleagues in health visiting, supporting what we do as well. So it's really trying to utilise all the expertise around us to address the kind of complex context that the children present in.
There's a lot of expertise out there and there's a lot of information out there, but one of the things you mentioned during your talk was that some people are having trouble accessing it, or that there's some kind of barrier there. So what is stopping that information from getting across to people?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of good and bad, but a lot of good information out there about sleep, and a lot of the things that we talk to parents about are pretty well known strategies and techniques, particularly around sleep hygiene. I think probably what we do within our service is a lot of unpicking as to why it's been difficult in the past to implement those things despite people having the knowledge. So I don't think it's necessarily access to knowledge that's the problem. I think it's helping to work out a way that the advice can be implemented. And obviously some of the children we see have problems that aren't purely to do with behaviour or sleep hygiene, and they require medical assessment, investigations, referral on and that kind of thing. So sometimes if basic things aren't working, it is worth asking yourself, is there something else going on here? Is there a physical medical issue or a psychological issue that hasn't been addressed?
How prevalent are sleep issues in children with complex neurodevelopmental conditions, and how does it impact these children in particular?
So the easy answer to that is extremely common. So figures for children with autism and ADHD, we're looking at 60-80%, huge proportions of these children that have essentially really common conditions as well. So common problems with sleep as a common complication. I suppose we know that sleep deprivation generally affects children's development. It affects their language development. It affects cognition, working memory, executive function, which is organisational skills, emotional regulation, social skills, behaviour, mental health. And parents of children who don't sleep are more likely to have problems in their family with family well-being, mental health. So if you take those consequences, as well as the physical consequences on growth and immunity, for example, and weight of sleep deprivation, and if you take those problems and you superimpose that onto a population who are already vulnerable because of their developmental difficulties, their physical health problems, and the vulnerability of the family because of all they're coping with, you can see that the impact can be really massive. So I think what we've essentially got is a problem, sleep problem, that causes that has lots of consequences, and children who are already vulnerable. And what we want to do is try and protect those children who are already vulnerable from the consequences of poor sleep.
Of course. You recently authored a best practice paper on managing sleep in children with ADHD in particular. What tips do you have for healthcare professionals on this?
It's a complicated one because we discussed in the conference sleep deprivation causes a picture that can look very much like ADHD, and we know children with ADHD are predisposed to poor sleep. So we are in a bit of a chicken and egg situation in a lot of times with children that have a phenotypic profile of ADHD and poor sleep. And I suppose my approach would be to assess the child holistically, to look at their developmental profile, to assess their sleep as part of it, to manage ADHD symptoms if they're there, and to manage sleep problems if they're there, and to do those alongside each other rather than getting caught up in a discussion or debate about which caused which, is to address the sleep problem and to put in the behaviour and parenting support for ADHD that you would usually do, and then to see what happens. I think it is important that we don't rush into diagnosing and treating ADHD without having addressed sleep. And equally, I think we shouldn't be referring children for sleep problems without having adequately managed their ADHD. So I think it's really just to be holistic and to try and support both aspects of the presentation.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to find more mental health resources, subscribe to our podcasts, check out our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on Twitter at acamh.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.